Today, provide you with in-depth news and expert analysis, tell you the whole story and the bigger picture. Bring you the news you want to know only on Today.
High-level China-U.S. trade talks set to resume later this week. U.S. and South Korea reached a hurried deal on military costs ahead of the second Trump-Kim summit. Thailand party accepts King's opposition to Princess Prime Minister bid, and France keeps up pressure on Italy in historic EU dispute. You're listening to Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Zhao Ying. Coming up, we'll have an hour of world news and analysis. To hear this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World News Analysis. U.S. negotiators are in Beijing for another round of talks on a trade deal, with the clock ticking towards the March 1st deadline set by U.S. President Donald Trump. Preliminary discussions by lower-level officials were to be held before the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin step in for the main event on Thursday and Friday. Washington suspended plans in December to increase tariffs on $200 billion U.S. dollars worth of Chinese imports to 25% from the current 10% to give negotiators space to resolve a trade spat that has triggered fears of a global economic slowdown. A previous round of talks in Washington last month ended without a deal. With more on this, we're now joined by Zhao Hai, research fellow with Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, and Xu Qingduo, our senior political analyst. So, Qingduo, to start with you, what will be at the center of this round of talks?
Well, if you listen to the State of the Union address by Donald Trump last week, obviously he mentioned about structural reform. Mostly that I would refer to, you know, according to people's understanding, for example, IPR production, and also like so-called technology transfer, things like that. For the U.S., they think it's unfair treatment of U.S. companies, of U.S. Products. So they would ask for some reforms, some changes from the Chinese side. And that probably, that what I referred to, that, you know, different media have different reports now, either IPR, either technology transfer, and also like how, if there's a comprehensive agreement, what we are going to implement those detailed, contents over there, probably that will also be part of the so-called center of talks for this round.
So, Dr. Zhao, what do you make of what Trump mentioned in the State of the Union address, that China needs, the trade deal with China needs to include real structural changes to resolve the complaints of unfair practices? What do you make of that?
I think there are backgrounds behind this, because China and U.S. have conducted dialogues for many years, and there are two things that the U.S. are not satisfied with the previous talks. Number one is China always, for instance, make big purchase from the U.S. while, from U.S. perspective, avoiding making real structural changes. And secondly, that even if China promised a certain structural change, the U.S. believe that China is not fulfilling or basically abide by those promises and not conducting the real structural change. So at this point, they emphasize the real structural change, meaning that they want to emphasize not only that China make the promise, but also these promises should be verifiable and enforceable. I think that's at the core of the next stage negotiations, that two sides needs to design a mutually verifiable mechanism. And also, if there's a violation, how to settle the dispute and how to enforce these agreements. I think that's going to be very important for the current and future negotiations.
So, Qingduo, what do you make of what's coming out of the previous two rounds of talks, and how optimistic are you that they could in some way strike a deal this time before the March deadline?
Well, there's if you look at the previous rounds of discussions, I think there's the optimism on both sides, the Chinese side and the U.S. side, based on the remarks released by those senior officials attending the talks over there. With that being said, of course, you know, few people are that optimistic that we are going to reach a deal at the this week's round of talks, because people say simply there's a lot of paperwork, too much details to finish the talks before the deadline on March 1st. I think, even we cannot finish all the talks until, say, March the 1st, but that doesn't mean there's no progress. Obviously, there's progress being made. We're not 100% sure what the progresses are. And I think people are pretty sure we are going to make new progress at the latest round of talks. The key is like whether that's enough for the both sides to declare a completion of talks before that deadline, and then we can sign a deal. Obviously, that seems less likely.
Well, Dr. Zhao, do you feel they can reach some kind of deal or maybe an extension of the deadline?
Well, I'm still optimistic about reaching some kind of structural deal before March 1st or probably around that time. If you look at the rounds that two sides conducted talks, from the first round to the second and now the third, the delegation size is increasing dramatically. And compared to the last time, this time the American team is bigger, basically double the size. And that means both sides are diving into deeper and deeper details of negotiations. And we're expecting probably, there will be some kind of a draft coming out of this round or next round talks. I agree with Xinduo that because of the complexity and the consequences of these talks, both sides are still trying to figure out exactly how to reach the final deal. So March 1st, now we have only about two weeks working days to reach this deal, and it's from the time perspective, it's really too tight to reach that. So that's why I think from American side there are leaks coming out and say talking about postponing that line, perhaps, and maybe there will be another Mar-a-Lago meeting probably in late March or probably early April. So I think the timeline could be moved if both sides believe there's enough progress, substantial progress, and both sides are satisfied with the current procedure.
Well, actually, U.S. President Donald Trump said on Thursday that he will not meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping before the March deadline. What does that tell about the process of the trade negotiations, Xinduo?
As Zhao had mentioned, the complexity and too many details or too much paperwork to be completely finished before the deadline on March the 1st. That's obviously one of the reasons people say the schedule would be too tight for the two leaders to meet. For the two leaders to meet, there got to be some substantial progress and probably the completion of the talks. Otherwise, what's the point of having the two leaders meet either in China, Vietnam, or United States? And secondly, there are probably the concern of where to meet, right before, say, the end of March the 1st, either in Beijing or Hanoi in Vietnam. Probably there are some disagreement. Also, I would say it's all partly, mostly because of the tight schedule. Simply, there's not enough time for the two leaders to prepare for the summit over there. Yeah.
So, Dr. Zhao, besides the tight schedule, do you feel maybe the two parties are still far apart at this point?
Well, there are bound to be issues that U.S. and China have different standing, and in particularly in structural issues related to state-owned enterprises, subsidies, and also non-tariff barriers. A lot of issues should be resolved in WTO and not bilaterally. But the U.S. try to press China on particular issues. At this point, the most important thing is technology-related, like technology theft, cyber espionage, and also all kinds of accusations in terms of tech transfer. So I think in that respect, China and the U.S. could work out some kind of agreement, particularly from the Chinese side, to reinforce protection of technology and IPR. That's in China's interest, basically for both sides' interest. So I think ultimately there will be some kind of deal in between, and some of the most thorny issues probably they will postpone for future talks and probably phase two or phase three talks.
Well, let me pick up on what Zhao has said about, say, for example, the IPR protection. And let me just show how difficult it is for China as a large country with 1.3 billion people. How difficult it is, the task is to protect IPR. The latest movie, the hit is The Wandering Earth, that is very popular with the Chinese cinema goers. And I think a couple of days later after the release of the movie, you see the cheap copycat online, basically with 2 yuan, you can watch the movie over there. You see, this is the challenge to the Chinese government of how to protect the IPR, not only from, say, foreign companies, but also the Chinese companies too. You know, a lot, increasing number of patents and also inventions actually are being made by the Chinese companies, Chinese side. There's an urgent need to better protect the IPR. I think there is a strong incentive on the side of Beijing to do a better job.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Thank you, Qin Duo, senior political analyst, and Zhao Hai, research fellow with Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. We'll come back to you in a minute. Stay with us.
I am Alka Acharya. I teach at the Jawaharlal Nehru University in India. Today has organized its programs and a stress on bringing in a lot of views from all over. It is an extremely good platform for information and analysis, and I wish it all success in the future.
Welcome back. You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. The U.S. and South Korea struck a hurried deal on the cost of the U.S. military presence, papering over a potential vulnerability in an upcoming U.S.-North Korean presidential summit later this month. Under the agreement, South Korea will contribute about $890 million a year for the U.S. military presence, an 8.2% increase from the previous five-year deal that expired at the end of last year. But that's less than the $1 billion or more the U.S. had asked for. The current deal still needs to be ratified by South Korean lawmakers before taking effect. So, Dr. Zhao, what has prompted the two sides to reach this hurried deal? Because as we know, previous rounds of negotiations had all failed, which even caused some worries about their alliances.
Yeah, well, before this deal, the last agreement between the U.S. and South Korea was signed in 2013, which was a five-year deal. And every year, based on that deal, every year South Korea will increase about 1% to put into the additional cost, to cover the additional cost. By the end of 2018, they should have signed another five-year deal. However, because the U.S. demand a 50% increase, the South Korea cannot accept that deal. The negotiation basically stalled and failed a couple of times. So now it's been 6 weeks past the deadline. They have to reach a deal, and they temporarily reached a one-year deal, which increased the South Korean cost about 8.2%. And this is only covered this year. And next year, they will have to negotiate another one, which will start in a couple of months. So if they cannot reach a deal by now, it's going to overlap with the next one. And because of the difficulties, because of the U.S. demand, now it's getting harder and harder for both sides to reach this deal. And even with this increase, 8-some percent, it's still very difficult for the South Korean government to swallow to get this deal back for the Congress to pass.
So, Qin Duo, what do you make of the timing of this deal being reached?
Well, I think, you know, for South Korea, obviously, they don't want to see becoming a like hot topic, like hot potato issue between Seoul and Washington, because for them, the priority is really about the Korean Peninsula nuclear issue. And they want to play along with the U.S. and also North Korean side to push forward some progress, some real progress in terms of the negotiation between Washington and Pyongyang. For the government of South Korea, they would love to see this issue quickly be buried, quickly be finished. But the parliament in South Korea, you know, people are not happy with that, with the increase of military spending to host the U.S. Troops over there. And for the U.S. side, you know, President Trump at one point even threatened to withdraw all the troops from the Korean Peninsula. But for the, let's say, traditionalist, like, the people would say that's crazy. That's a crazy idea, because having troops in the Korean Peninsula is in the interest of the United States, not only in the interests of South Korea. So I think there's an understanding to a certain level that's serving the interests of both nations. Probably you got to compromise. You got to reach an agreement at some point. I think that's basically why we're having the deal now.
So, Dr. Zhao, we know the Trump administration has been trying to reach similar deals with other allies that host large U.S. military bases, such as Japan, such as Germany. So do you think the deal with South Korea will make that a bit easier?
Well, first of all, these arrangements are vestige of World War II and the Korean War. And these payment to the United States is actually a tribute payment to the U.S., and that effectively turned both South Korea, Japan, and Germany into half-sovereign states. And I think in that respect, it's very difficult for those sovereign government to persuade its people to pay such a due. So that's why the negotiations are quite difficult at this point, because now President Trump are threatening those countries to pull troops out if those countries are not increasing their share of those costs. For instance, I mean, compared to South Korea, Japan and Germany's case are different because they have a different number of military bases, a different number of military personnel, and different functions. And I think that deal, those deals will be negotiated individually aside from the South Korean deal. However, this deal, South Korean's deal reached with the United States, will be very significant because, of course, the U.S., particularly President Trump, will use this deal to pressure other parties to accept higher burden-sharing costs.
And let's go back to the Korean Peninsula issue. So, Qingde, what do you think this could mean to the second round of Trump-Kim summit, which will be held in Vietnam later this month?
Well, this just, put aside the differences between Seoul and Washington. Obviously, there's more than cost sharing of hosting the U.S. Army, U.S. troops in the Korean Peninsula. They don't really see eye to eye in terms of the speed of progress in the Korean Peninsula negotiation over there. And of course, now with the negotiation being done, so they can focus on the negotiation with the North Korean side over there. And my expectation, of course, there are, basically like two different ideas. For people who are critical of Donald Trump, they would say this summit would be a repeat of the first summit, that ended with a less than one page long agreement. So they don't expect much from the second summit. But then, people, the other side of the people would say, people are expecting some real progress, some substantial, say, concessions to be made by both sides. The U.S. special envoy also mentioned about the U.S. indicate the U.S. might make some concessions in terms of declaring the end of the Korean War and announcing peace between the two countries. So that's something North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has been looking for. And for North Korean side, they have already made some preparatory steps in the words of the U.S. special envoy. Basically, it's that, about the closing to test the sides. So it's about, whether they can continue this mutual steps. For the Korean side, they can get more guarantee in terms of their security. For the U.S. side, they want to see the real progress about, destroying all the nuclear weapons, all the sets.
And Dr. Zhao, and many noticed that while announcing the location of their next meeting on Twitter, Trump also said that North Korea, under the leadership of Kim Jong-un, will become a great economic powerhouse, and North Korea will become a different kind of rocket, an economic one. So is he hinting at lifting the sanctions on North Korea?
Well, I think at this point, it's not exactly lifting the sanctions against North Korea. However, he wanted to paint an economic future for North Korea if North Korea gave up its nuclear program. And Trump has continued to use this incentive, trying to persuade North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to accept that future. And if you think about why Vietnam has been chosen as the next round of talks location, it's because the U.S. wanted to use Vietnam as a successful case of peaceful development without having nuclear weapons or ICBM. So I think in that respect, they wanted to showcase Vietnam's economic trajectory and also Vietnam's closeness and current good relationship with the United States as the future for North Korea to follow. However, I think at this point, without North Korea commit to further denuclearize, it's very hard for Trump to go against domestic and international opposition to unilaterally lower the sanction.
Well, let's move on to Trump's domestic problems. We know that talks between congressional Republicans and Democrats aimed at averting another U.S. government shutdown have broken down without agreement. The negotiators were hoping for a delay by Monday to give Congress time to pass legislation by Friday when last month's federal funding deal runs out. The impasse centers on Democratic demands to lift the detention of irregular migrants already in the U.S. The previous shutdown, lasting 35 days, was the longest in U.S. history. So, Qingzhou, what is this latest impasse about?
Obviously, this is focusing on, as the previous shutdown over illegal immigrants issue. This issue has been one of the many controversial issues in the United States or in the domestic politics. Obviously, Democrats and the Republicans have different opinions on how to solve this problem. With the taking office by the Trump administration, obviously, they focused very much on the conservative agenda. That is, they have to do something to stop the inflow of illegal immigrants, so-called. And in particular, from the southern part of America, that's Latin America, from Mexico and countries like El Salvador. So, one way to do that for conservatives is really to establish a wall, to build a wall, a solid wall over there to stop the inflow of those people, caravan, let's say. And for the Democrats, the issue is more than building a wall. It's more than illegal immigrants. It's about having a legal means for those who were born in the United States but from, say, illegal parents over there, gave them the way to legalize their presence in the United States, so-called dreamers, to help them realize their dreams. And also for those illegal immigrants already living in the United States, how to deal with them. And then that will be about stopping probably the illegal inflow of the illegal immigrants, let's say. So that's, the key issue. Donald Trump is asking for $5.7 billion to build the wall. For the Democrats who controlled this the House chamber, they would say that's a no-no, big no-no. So I'm not sure they can reach an agreement on that.
So, Dr. Zhao, how much of a risk is there that there could be another government shutdown in the U.S.?
Just days before the current White House Chief of Staff, Mulvaney, came out and said there's absolutely a high possibility that the government would shut down if the Congress cannot reach a deal. And I believe that the threat is real because President Trump also, I think just as late as yesterday, came out and said that he would shut down the government if this negotiations between the two parties in Congress broke down. And it looks like that as the deadline approaches, it's more and more likely that the president will use national emergency power to build his wall and without the approval of the Congress, which will lead to a big legal battle between the two sides. And at this time, I think President Trump took the first strike against the Democrats so that he can accuse the Democrats as the culprits for the next shutdown without the backlash from the general public against him. And as Qingzhou has pointed out, at this point, it's a big mess and it's very hard. Both sides are holding fast for their own position without giving the other side an inch. So it's at this point, it's very hard to see where the middle ground is and how they could reach a final deal.
Well, Qingzhou, if we look back into the history, has it ever proved to be effective in any way by using the closure of federal agencies to solve any kind of policy disputes?
I mean, national emergency.
I mean, the government shutdown.
yes and no. In a way, if there's a prolonged government shutdown, that does create some pressure on the political parties to reach like a kind of compromise, at least a temporary compromise, to open the market, to open the government. Otherwise, the public would probably be angry at both parties, not only at the party who are running the White House, but also the other parties too. So that's why you have a temporary opening right now we are having in the U.S. until February 15th. So the problem is like whether they can solve their problem, whether they can reach a deal in such a short period of time. So the topic itself is very complicated. Remember, it could be illegal immigrants, you know, on the grounds of like, oh, they are robbing us of our jobs, or they are being illegal. We have to solve this problem. But also, it could be a large issue. A large picture is like, it's just as mentioned in the book, like, who are we? Identity politics. Then it's more complicated, like, you know, what kind of America that will be in the future.
Okay, thank you, Xu Qingde, our senior political analyst, and Zhao Hai, research fellow with Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. Thank you both for joining our discussion this evening. Coming up, Thailand party accepts King's opposition to Princess Prime Minister bid, and France keeps up pressure on Italy in a historic EU dispute. To hear this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World News Analysis. I'm Zhao Ying. Stay with us. You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Now is Global Survey, where we look at what's happening around the world. Joining me in the studio is my colleague Ge Anna.
Thanks, Zhao Ying. Let's look at Asia first. In disputed Kashmir, five rebels were killed in fighting with government forces, triggering anti-India clashes in which at least 10 civilians were injured. In India, at least 99 people have died and scores have been hospitalized after drinking toxic alcohol, leading to a crackdown against bootleggers in the country.
In Oceania, the sacked coach of the Australian women's football team has strongly contested his shock dismissal over claims of an unsatisfactory team environment 5 months before the World Cup. Fires that have ravaged part of New Zealand over the last week, with an estimated 3,000 people evacuation, could still be burning well into March.
In Africa, Algeria's 81-year-old president, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, who has been in office for 20 years but has rarely been seen in public due to health concerns, will seek a fifth term in April's election. An office for Nigeria Election Commission has been burned down just 6 days before the country is due to vote in a general election.
Turning to the Middle East, U.S.-backed fighters in Syria say they are meeting fierce resistance in the last enclave held by up to 600 Islamic State militants near the Iraqi border. Coupled with anti-U.S. sentiments, hundreds of thousands of Iranians attended nationwide rallies to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
In Europe, supporters of Spanish conservative and centrist parties have held a protest in the capital city of Madrid against the government plans to hold talks with Catalan separatists. British Prince Philip has given up his driver's license at the age of 97 after his involvement in a car accident north of London a month ago.
Looking to Latin America, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has pledged the government would make investments to provide the country's armed forces and militia with the most advanced military equipment and warned other countries against trying to threaten Venezuela. Opposition demonstrators in Haiti have burnt tires and thrown stones, urging the president to step down.
Finally, in North America, President Donald Trump plans to sign an executive order directing federal agencies to prioritize research and development in the field of artificial intelligence. And staying in the country, Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, who recently announced a running for president of 2020 election, suggested President Donald Trump might be in jail by then.
Thank you, Anna. That's the global headline for today. The party that nominated a Thai princess to run for prime minister has said it will comply with the king's wishes after he opposed the move. On Friday, King Vahiralakorn denounced his sister Princess Wubaratana Mahido's unprecedented bid for political power as inappropriate. The candidacy would have broken with the tradition of the Thai royal family publicly staying out of politics. The party said it complied with the royal command with loyalty to the king and all members of the royal family. A palace statement said such an act would defy the nation's culture. My colleague Ding Heng has been following this. So Ding Heng, could you tell us more about this princess?
Well, so Princess Ubratana's lifestyle actually has not always followed traditional royal pathways. She relinquished her royal title in the 1970s after she married a foreigner and moved to the United States. But, eventually she returned to Thailand after divorcing her former American husband. She has then acted in Thai films, in Thai soap operas. She is an active social media user in Thailand. So basically the general public in Thailand is pretty familiar with her.
So what has motivated the princess to enter politics?
I think it is not clear at this point. I am not even sure, frankly speaking, whether she herself is 100% willing to do so. The political party she will represent is called the Thai Riksa Chart Party. So this party is closely linked to former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra, who has been living in exile after he was ousted in a military coup in the year 2006. And in addition to politics, Thaksin is also a well-known telecommunication tycoon, a very rich people, a very rich businessman, basically influential in both business and politics. He faced the charges including corruption and abuse of power in Thailand. Now, although he lives in exile, he has continued to influence Thai politics through political parties, some of which he is the founder. And by the way, the prime minister from the year 2011 to the year 2014, Inluck, the beautiful young lady, is his younger sister. So basically, the upcoming March election is seen as a battle between Thaksin's political allies who have remained in Thailand and the pro-military establishment in Thailand. It is widely believed that the Thaksin has played some role behind the nomination of princess princess. They probably believe he is she is popular. She is from the royal family, so there is a big chance for her to win. So I think that this princess is their political leverage.
Well, the king said on Friday night that to involve a high-level member of the royal family in politics, directly or indirectly, is against royal traditions, norms, and national culture. And he added that it is deemed extremely inappropriate. But the thing is, does the king's statement have an effect on the princess' decision or ability to run?
Yeah, I think that's for sure. I think that will be the case. The Thailand's election commission will have to rule on the candidacy of the princess by this Friday. And I think one thing for us to keep in mind is that the Thailand king is considered semi-divine according to Thailand's own culture, that's part of their culture, even though the king himself doesn't have too much real political-based power. So I think it's unlikely that the member of the election commission will disregard the wishes of the king. The royal family, like you said in your introduction, Zhao Ying, has a long-standing tradition of keeping some distance between them and politics. And the election law in Thailand actually forbids political parties from using the monarchy in their political campaigns. Therefore, some political activists could even argue that this move by Thaksin's political allies to nominate the princess has violated the Thailand's law. And as punishment, the party, the Thai Riksa Chart Party, could be even banned from the March election. That's one possibility. So I think we still need to wait and see whether this strategy to nominate the princess is successful. There are chances for the strategy to backfire.
Why is this election important to the country?
So basically, parties royal to Thaksin have won every election since the year 2001. But since 2006, each of their government has been overthrown by either by court rulings or by military coups. In other words, you know, there is a very interesting phenomenon here. There has long been a kind of cycle of Taksin's political allies winning elections, then the military not accepting their tenure, not accepting their government, a military coup happening, and then the military government plans to return to democracy, and then Taksin's political allies wins once again. So if this time this princess could somehow win the elections, you could possibly put an end to such a political cycle, because the military and the monarchy in Thailand have always been closely allied with each other. So this idea of a possible power struggle between the military and the royal family is pretty unthinkable in Thailand. Then, if that's the case, there could be the possibility of Taksin returning to ending her exile and returning to Thailand. If that's the case, that will be a very bad scenario for the military.
Are there any reactions by the military government yet?
Of course, the military has to do something. The current prime minister, Prayut Chan-o-cha, who is a retired army general and who took power after the 2014 military coup, has already announced that he will also take part. He will also contest in the March election. And one thing to keep in mind is that this upcoming election has been delayed for many times by the military government. And the military government, as a matter of fact, has spent many years beforehand scripting a new constitution to ensure that the military will continue to have a strong foothold on power after the March election. So I believe in whatever case, the military will remain as a pretty powerful force in Thailand. So the situation is pretty unpredictable.
Thank you, Ding Hong, for joining us this evening. Coming up, France keeps up pressure on Italy in historic EU dispute. You're listening to Today. We'll be back in a minute.
What matters to China increasingly matters to the world. Keep up to date with the latest news and events about the Middle Kingdom with the China Plus app. Up-to-the-minute reports, live streaming audio, insightful opinion on everything China-related. Facts, figures, and language learning resources at your fingertips. Everything in focus, all in one place. Search for China Plus in the App Store or Google Play.
You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Relations between Italy and France are continuing to deteriorate after France recalled its ambassador to Italy. The French side has also compared relations between the two countries to when they were on opposite sides during World War II. The war of words between Rome and Paris started last year over the issue of immigration. France criticized the Italian government's closed-door immigration policies, while Italy said France had a colonial attitude towards Africa. The high-profile standoff intensified last week when Luigi Di Maio, head of the populist Five Star Movement, meeting with the anti-government Yellow Vest protesters outside of Paris. Meanwhile, Matteo Salvini, another Italian deputy prime minister and leader of the Eurosceptic League, said he hoped France will soon be able to free themselves from a terrible president. For more on this, we're now joined on the line by Mr. Patrick Bech, journalist with AFP, and Luca Silipo, chief economist with Giardis. So, Patrick, to start with you, what would you say are the main reasons behind this spat between the two major EU members?
Well, I think what happened is that since they came to power, the populist government in Italy had very strong accusations against France, especially against the French President Emmanuel Macron. As you mentioned, France was accused of continuing to colonize Africa and being responsible for the migration from Africa to Europe. And then the Italian Interior Minister Salvini mentioned that he would summon the French Interior Minister to Rome, which is quite unheard of between two European countries. So, of course, the situation deteriorated. One thing you might want to say is that there are indeed some longer-term issues between the two countries, maybe not only between the two countries, but between Italy and the rest of Europe. One case in particular is the case of immigration. I mean, Italy was left to fend for itself, almost on its own, during all these years when immigrants were crossing the Mediterranean. And other European countries didn't take their share of immigrants. So that created certainly some resentment from Italy. And also, Italy was also left to itself with all its economic troubles. The Europeans came to the help of Greece, because it's a much smaller economy, but didn't really help Italy. And so the Italian economy has been doing very badly for the past decades. And so this has created some tension between Italy and the rest of Europe, not particularly France.
Well, Luca, did all this start after Italy's right-leaning coalition taking power last year, or even earlier than that?
No, I think Patrick is right when he says that there is a long-standing issues on immigration, and Italy has been has felt to be left alone on this, and somehow this is true. So this long-standing thing happened. However, of course, the election of the Northern League and the Five Star Movement in the as leaders basically of Italy, of course, it worsened the situation. But I think it's very important to understand, at least from the side of Italy, that this spat with France now has two kind of channel. One is immigration. And it's why, for example, Matteo Salvini is very active on this front, probably too active. And the other one is the Gilets Jaunes, so the street protesters that are still gripping weekends in many cities in France. And this stream is why the Five Star Movement is interested in this. So it's a double attack or a double target. Which are completely different from the two coalition members that rule Italy. One is interested to attack France on the immigration stance, and the other one is interested to attack France because it sees in this yellow vest movement something very similar to the Five Star Movement in Italy.
Well, Patrick, the Italian minister attacked President Macron and met with the Yellow Vest protesters. It is like the state leaders openly encouraging confrontation in another country. So how unprecedented is this, particularly among major European countries in the post-war era?
Well, it's completely unprecedented. And so is unprecedented the fact that an ambassador from a European country should be recalled from another country. But I think that never happened since 1945. So, that's just unheard of. And especially because the situation in France is extremely tense. You've got the Yellow Vest movement, which is something very difficult for the French government to handle because there are no leaders, there's no agenda. It's very difficult to understand what they want. When some of their members try to negotiate with the government, then other members of the Yellow Vest attack them because they're being accused of being traitors. So now the only thing which seems to be left in their agenda is to ask for Macron's resignation. And of course, this is completely, this is not something that is going to happen because he's been democratically elected less than 2 years ago. So when you see a government from a different country supporting that movement, which has turned violent sometimes, of course, the French government cannot accept that.
Well, Luca, Salvini had earlier said that it is time to oppose the France-German axis with an Italian-Polish axis. So he's basically trying to challenge France and Germany's dominance in the EU. So do you think the right-wing populist parties will be represented even more strongly in the parliament after the elections in May?
On one hand, the answer to my comment to your question is that it's just a populist stance to say that Italy can attack or can participate in high talks between France and Germany for the destiny of Europe. I would I'm Italian, but I would say if I were Germany or France, I would say, okay, what do you bring to the table? Because Italy, as the Italian economy is very weak and it's a problem for Europe. It brings down the value and the economic reputation of Europe with very low productivity and very very bad record in structural reform. So on one hand, there is this idea. On the other hand, and probably more in a more positive, at least in their own way, is the fact that behind this this idea of the international or pan-European populist union, there is an idea that goes beyond the nation state. And I think this is a very important topic that we will have to deal in the future, how the nation state represents what the citizens want today and how economy works today. And I think all this probably more serious behind the words of Salvini is this idea that the nation states are an old concept and there is something more and something different that the citizens want. And that is not very clarified up to now, but will have to be dealt with.
So, Patrick, what's your take? Is the far right set to overrun European politics?
I think this is wishful thinking for the time being on the part of Mr. Salvini and others. I mean, you have to remember that Salvini has a very good friend in France. It's Marine Le Pen, the leader of the extreme right, who was Macron's main opponent during the last presidential election. Her party now seems to be ahead on the opinion polls for the upcoming European elections, but they have like 24% of support in the opinion polls, so that's still very, very far from overwhelming French politics and even European politics. What we may see at the next European elections is a very low turnout from voters, which could help parties like the National Front in France and other populist parties elsewhere in Europe.
Yes, please continue.
But then the European Parliament doesn't have much power. So even if these parties were to have a stronger share of the seats at the European Parliament, that would certainly not upstage European politics.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Patrick Bach, journalist with AFP, and Lucas Silippo, chief economist with Geodis. You're listening to Today. We'll be back in a minute.
With the great efforts made by the staff, Today become one of the great platforms for policy debates and information dissemination. And I wish Today have an even brighter and greater tomorrow.
You're listening to Today. I'm Zhaoying. Now joining us for other news is Ge Anna.
Thanks, Zhaoying. Today we have a marriage theme for the other news segment. So first of all, let's talk about a Kuwaiti couple got divorced just 3 minutes after the completion of their marriage registration.
So what happened?
The couple just signed their marriage contract in front of a judge, and then the bride accidentally tripped it on her way out. Instead of clutching her in the first reaction and expressing concerns, the groom laughed at her and called her stupid. So after being mocked, the woman flew into a rage and demanded the judge dissolve their marriage right away. So the couple received annulment before they left the courthouse they got married in. And the marriage is believed to have become the shortest ever in Kuwait's history.
But they just had been married for only 3 minutes. Has the bride overreacted?
Actually, the incident provoked a wave of sympathy for the women on social media, with netizens suggesting she was right to end it. One Twitter user said, many agreed, if this is how he reacts right at the beginning, it is better to leave him. Who knows how he gonna react when something matters really happened. And another one added, a marriage with no respect is a failed one right from the beginning. However, some netizens beg to differ. They believe that it's just a small thing, won't even count for a challenge for their marriage. So getting a divorce is overreacted. Marriage is not a game. If there is really something wrong with the groom and everything has built up to this very point, then she should think it through before even go to the court to get married at the first place.
So let's move on to our next topic.
While the Kuwait guy is worried about how to redeem love and marriage with his ex-wife, the Hungarian prime minister is taking pains and having headache with his country's low birth rate. Recently, in his annual speech, he announced about a 7-point action plan trying for baby boom with tax breaks and loan forgiveness in order to tackle population decline.
What exactly did the Hungarian prime minister propose?
The main message is that Hungarian women with 4 children or more will be exempted for life from paying income tax. And as part of the measures, young couple will be offered interest-free loans of $36,000 to be cancelled once they have 3 children. In addition to that, other points in the government's plan include a pledge to create 21,000 nursery places over the next 3 years, an extra $2.5 billion to be spent on the country's healthcare system, and provide housing subsidies and state support for those buying 7-seat vehicles. So you can see all those measures contributed to the increase of fertility rate in the country.
So how urgent is the population decline issue in Hungary?
According to their official, it's very. Hungary's population is falling by 32,000 a year, and women there have fewer children than the EU average. The fertility rate in the country is 1.45. This puts the country below the EU's average of 1.58. And Mr. Prime Minister of Hungary said, I quote, the answer to falling birth rates in Europe was immigration. For every missing child, there should be one coming in, and then the number will be fine. But Hungarian people think differently. We don't need numbers, we need Hungarian children. So this is pretty much the reason why Hungary announces this bold 7-point action plan to fight population decline.
Thank you, Anna. That's all the time we have for this edition of today. A quick recap of today's headlines. High-level China-US trade talks set to resume later this week. US and South Korea reached a hurried deal on military costs ahead of the second Trump-Kim summit. U.S. shutdown talks stall ahead of deadline. Thailand party accepts King's opposition to Princess Prime Minister bid. And France keeps up pressure on Italy in historic EU dispute. To listen to this episode again or catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World News Analysis. The program engineer of this episode is Holly May. I'm Zhao Ying. Thank you so much for listening.